Hello. Today in the Loopcast, I have Sarah Hightower, and we're discussing just a whole range of topics. So this show today is like the third in our kind of experimental series, or something that I would call an experimental series, where I find friends and mutuals that I'm very fond of listening to or reading their analysis and their insight and bringing them on the show. So our first experiment was with Marc-Andre Argentino. So we just gave him this opportunity to come on the show and talk about what interests him. In that case, it was collecting materials in extremist spaces. Our second experiment was with our friends Emmy and Alex on Gamergate. So that was an example of having a really important topic that hasn't really been picked over by academics or analysts or whatever, but very much known to researchers. And we wanted to have a conversation on that. And then our third show today is with Sarah, where somebody who is incredibly brilliant, incredibly insightful, we just bring them onto the show and just ask questions and start a conversation. So in this case, it might be, you might find it super insightful, or it might just be about wrestling. So we're going to see where it takes. And our fourth show in this experimental series is going to be a book club with Upchurch on Foucault's Pendulum. So I've been kind of experimenting with this idea of doing like a book club, where we just sit down, we read a book, and we kind of pick it apart. It's, I don't know how it'll go, but it just, you know, it just sounds fun and sounds interesting and sounds something like we would enjoy listening to. So with that being said, please welcome Sarah Hightower. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Scott. Big fan. Really glad to be here. I've been a fan for like, oh my God, man. Like at least before y'all were on IFC, before y'all got the IFC show, like back when you were still Comedy Death Ray.
Yeah, it's the IFC show really made a difference.
Yeah, no, it was like, I prefer like the Reggie episodes, but it was pretty cool what he brought on Kid Cudi too. I don't like, I try to love everyone. And that's what I love about Comedy Bang Bang. Like, it's just, it's really just a positive place where we can all just get together and vibe, get into some laughs.
Yeah, it's, we're very much known for our very positive, happy vibe. With that being said, so you're very much known to be a scholar of, I'm going to mispronounce it, Shinriko, that one, the infamous one. So if you could just walk us through, how did you get into studying Ohm? Like, was it like, tell us that story.
No, I was a baby weeb on 9/11. I read a book. How does anyone get into anything? You read about it in an anime magazine when you're 10, and then you read a book after 9/11.
An anime magazine?
That's how we're all here. Like, that's why.
I mean, what kind of fascinates you? What kept you going? I mean, at 10, you're cracking open, you know, an anime magazine. You're saying that that's kind of neato burrito, but I'm assuming you're a little older now, just a little bit. What kept you sort of engaged with it? What sort of fascinated you as an intellectual?
Because as an intellectual, I guess you could say you want to understand something. You approach something because you want to understand it. And then I understood it and it clicked. And I was like, my God, he just like me. He just like me for real. It's like that meme. It was that, but I was a child and I was also very angry at certain things in my life. And just in the world. And you want to understand what would make someone beat the hell out of you and your mom when you're like a little kid. You want to understand what makes somebody really racist. Or you want to understand what makes somebody blow up a bunch of kids next door or fly a plane into a building or release a bunch of sarin into the subway. And then it clicks and you kind of understand it, emotionally at least. You like, I read Lifton. Red Lifton's destroying the world to save it. And he gets into the psychology of Ohm. And I'm like, okay, no, I understand what this man is putting down. And I see how we got from point A to point B to the Marinocchi line. But like, you get that when like you're a kid. And I was just so fascinated with it. And so I tried to stick with it. But like, this is like 2001, the trials were still going. And there was hardly any information in English. And then back then, like we had to use like Babelfish translator, the Alta Vista, like those old machine translators. So I've been doing this since I was in like middle school. And I've just stuck with it the entire time, basically. I took a few years off when it looked like they weren't going to be executed. I was an idiot. Because that ended up happening. But for a while, we thought it wasn't. And now I'm here. Thanks for having me on.
Nothing funnier than Comedy Bang Bang.
I'm workshopping a new character.
I'm workshopping.
It's called Complex PTSD Girl. Knows a lot about the terror.
I really shouldn't laugh at that, but
No, it's cool. No, you shouldn't, because it's like it's just not funny.
you're right. But now in my head, it's just like, I'm picturing a sketch comedy show where they have Complex PTS girl and podcast guy, and then suddenly it'll take like a turn for the weird, and then you try to explain that to an audience, and it's like, ah. Like there's it might like hit with like five people, I guess. But it's something that I find fascinating is the use of Lifton. Like he's so influential, and I feel like I came to Lifton kind of late, which is kind of a shame because he's so influential, but at the same time, it's like so much of his cultic studies are like if I remember correctly, it's Ulm, then it's North Korean prison camps in the big book that is over in the corner of the room that I can't remember the title. But when you take Lifton and you kind of pair it with your own personal experience, how do we sort of understand extremism and cults, like from your study of, and then sort of combining this with Lifton? Did you find that your study challenged what Lifton was saying, or do you find it that it was very validating that what Lifton had written about was very true and very sort of real?
I mean, I have very pro-Lifton bias, but yeah, no, it all jived. And then I came back and I started like raising hell about QAnon. And then we all watched that happen in real time. So yeah, that 3 or 4 year old, like, what am I saying? Wait, sorry, let me rewind that. Yeah, that 3 or 4 year span of just like an absolute fucking slow motion living hell. I was literally just like, I was checking off the things that Lifton has written. It was, I've tried to go on shows. I've tried to, that big book that you were talking about, the one where we get the brainwashing from.
Like it's right in the
We're
corner
gonna
of the room.
edit this.
This is going to be a bit of a
Oh God, this is why you don't bring me on shows.
but I think it's important though, like
Yeah,
you
but like, I have to warm up. Look at me. I'm a complicated lady. I got a lot of big thoughts. Very, very important.
I mean in the sense that like lift I mean lift and offer like I feel like when I read or engage with Lifton, it's almost offering a sort of predictive power, right? So it's kind of, I felt like he wrote these things. They were all pre-internet, but then, like as you said, as we were kind of watching Q become Q, it was just like, check boxes almost. But would you? I mean, like going back to Ulm, like when you're kind of looking at Ulm and then looking at like Q. Like how much of it was like it was just direct comparison, right? So it's like, oh, here we go. Here's the apocalyptic vision. Here's the sort of othering, severe othering, and this and sort of,
Here's the
everything.
information control. Here's the cultic jargon. Here's the loaded language. Here's the isolation. Here's the in-group, out-group fuckery. Yeah.
Right. But I mean,
Yeah, no.
is there a point where that comparison kind of stopped being useful? Like
Yeah.
in the sense that when I begin to conceptualize Q, I think of it as very online, right? And I think as an amateur or as me as an amateur in this space, I usually have to associate a cult with a physical space, right? So like the MEK, Scientology, are all like linked to physical spaces, if I'm understanding these correctly, right? They have compounds, apartment buildings, whatever, but Q was very much completely online. So how do we kind of challenge Lifton, or how do we sort of hammer, Lifton's ideas into the online age? Because I would also point out you're fairly young compared to the majority of cultic you know, studies. Like Alexandra Stein is, you know, in her 60s. The other guests we've had on the show that have discussed cults. And then Rothschild, when we had him discussing his book, he gets it in the ballpark, I feel like. Like, you know, Q is just, you know, evolution of these other online conspiracy theories. But he kind of, like, I want to kind of really understand what is the online, capital O, has done to our understanding of cults and extremism.
But here's the thing, though, like, the online stuff hindered understanding of QAnon, and it hindered, like, any sort of timely, I guess you could say, like, I don't know, response that we could have had, which really messed with me for a few years there, because I would try, and I got weird brain, big thoughts, bad words, so I guess I couldn't communicate well enough. All I kept getting back for so long was, it's not a cult, get a new brand. It's not a cult, it's online. And then if anybody ever did want to say it was a cult, they just wanted to make a Jonestown joke. So it's really frustrating. And it's, but like, QAnon wasn't even the first online movement, like cultic type movement of its kind. It's really endlessly frustrating. And you can view it through the lens of, like, you know, hoity-toity, you know, real academia like Lifton, or you can get down into the trenches and you can view it through the lens of, like, internet fandom stuff, like horror stories, like the Final Fantasy VII house, like that thing. Or you can, like, rewind it back and you can just start picking through those very online conspiracy theories that started hooking our memes and pep-peps back in the Usenet era. It's all going to line up, and anything that you bring from those perspectives, like, will be equally valid. But no, it's like just the public understanding of a cult having to be something with a physical compound, instead of just like perhaps like the 36 chambers of just like fucking mental imprisonment, like this process that it actually is that fucks up your brain and changes the way your brain works and changes the way you perceive reality. It was a bad time. I've had a very bad time. I'm rambling. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I mean, like, that's something that kind of fascinates me, like the online, its ability to distort reality, I guess. I mean, like, we were talking about it before, like, it almost strikes me like kayfabe and wrestling. Like, it's clearly very real, but it's also fake. It's also performative. And it's like, you know, to be honest, I struggle to I'm very online, but I struggle to actually understand the online. Like, it just, like, people kind of radicalizing into cults seems so alien to me. Like, I try to refrain from making fun of, you know, people who've joined Q, and I try to refrain from mockery, but then it's like I just sit there, like, at the end of the day, and I just struggle to understand it. Like, you know, like, reality has been distorted so much, and then it's like all the person has to do is just log off. Like,
it stays with you, especially if it's like something that you've come to fundamentally believe, and especially if you assign this importance, this literal apocalyptic life or death, most important thing ever, and we just happen to be here in this moment for it, importance to something. It's not like that Tyler the Creator tweet. Like, it's really not as simple as just looking away and walking away. You know, if you're already really wrapped up in it and it's very real to you. Yes, they're fueled by hatred now, but there's also an element of fear. There's also this, like, have you ever been scared of something? Have you ever, like, been scared of something and you thought, like, you might immediately be in danger? Your fight or flight kicked in.
I think it's...
And that adrenaline.
Yeah.
Yeah, your brain just floods with, like, these chemicals. If you just look at epinephrine and the norepinephrine, all this stuff, right? Okay, they're literally, like, it's like they're literally addicted to that.
Oh, that's wild. I can't imagine being in, like, that state of mind for 2 years.
I don't see it as that. But yeah, no, it's like they've... whether it's by design or whether it's just kind of how it works, it really it's preying on people's emotions. And when you experience certain emotions, your brain gets flooded with certain chemicals. It's like the way people get addicted to Twitter, just scrolling endlessly, trying to get some likes and retweets, and the joke about, you know, your serotonin lottery on social media, right? It's that same sort of principle. Like, your brain makes you feel a certain way. Hate can tickle your brain in a certain way. Fear, anger, sadness.
I mean, that's something that's really interesting, because now it almost seems like you, I mean, I think you're right, and I think Lifton is right, but it's like you don't really need physicality or a physical sort of expression of a cult, right? You don't need those compounds. Rather, it's all occurring in your head. Would that be accurate to say, or we can sort of extend this idea out a bit?
You can have, I think, in Destroying the World to Save It, part of what made it click with me was when Lifton gets into Timothy McVeigh and the Turner Diaries and Oklahoma City bombing in the context of this own stuff and the cultic experience. And he literally describes Timothy McVeigh's obsession with Turner as his own cultic experience.
Interesting. So, I mean, so it's just like, you know, when conceptualizing a cult, I think about, like, you know, Q's genesis, like it's sort of spreading, right? And it couldn't have been done without bringing the normies in. And like, a lot of it seems to be linked to Facebook. A lot of it seems to be linked to aggregators and the ability to create a closed off information environment. So it's like you don't necessarily need to close off the physical environment. You just have to kind of produce a closed information environment.
Information control.
But that information control isn't coming from a centralized leader. Rather, it's kind of an individual's choices compounded with kind of the Facebook sort of algorithm or closed groups, or I hate blaming it on technology, but it just seems like really clear that recommendation algorithms and kind of closed groups on Facebook are partly responsible for creating that information seal.
Yeah, but you also have to remember, like, the early days of QAnon, when it was just starting to, like, reach out to, the above top secret forums, that first big calm before the storm subreddit, and what they called QTube at the time, the big QTubers who were making, like, propaganda videos out of Q drops and stuff, like little scripts that they would just pay people to read with the appropriate imagery on screen and stuff like that. This was in the early days. Like, you had these influencers in the community, in this fledgling community, that would interpret these Q drops, the word of Q, who is bringing you the jumbled up, riddled word of the higher power itself, right? These influencers helped guide this community and helped shape the way, they kind of helped shape the Q canon, I guess you could say. But also, you had Q, he would come along and they would tweet, or not tweet, they would come along, they would say things like, disinformation is necessary. Like, I remember being online with, like, Travis View and Mike Rothschild and some of the anti-Q people the day that Q said disinformation is necessary. And I was like, nope, we're fucked. Like, we're totally screwed. That right there is that's cinching it. That's not good. That's, like, the worst thing they could have said. Because that officially just, like, disinformation is necessary, which means that, like, they're no longer even just, like, they can't even be held to the pretense of, like, just telling the truth. They can say anything and it could, like, be wrong later. Or someone close to them now could say something and get excommunicated later. And it doesn't matter because disinformation is necessary. We just wrote ourselves a blank check that says we can lie to you.
That's interesting. Like there's, like, the canon production. Like, I assume that in Ulm, that the canon and the sort of liturgy, I don't know what to call it, like texts, right, were more centralized, whereas like Q was, my understanding of it is that it's absolutely decentralized and that it kind of represents more of a fandom, right? Everybody gets to, you know, write a cute. Oh, go ahead.
No, go on.
I mean, like in the sense that like the way that Mike Rothschild describes it and the way that Q documentary describes it, like canon production in the QAnon space was just like, was literally people writing comments or adding ideas. And then the bread maker is kind of deciding these threads are kind of neato burrito and then promoting them. And then suddenly that would become canon. So when we think about canon production and text production, you know, how do we conceptualize it then? Is the centralization, decentralization mechanism not even that important, but rather it's just the myth and the ideas that are being generated, like take more primacy over it?
I think that's a pretty valid way of looking at it, actually, when you put it like that, yeah.
Okay. But I mean, like, it also makes research kind of difficult, right? Like, it's just, like, hearing, well, I guess the Alex and his group, the Q historian people, like, it's just wild to me that they have been able to kind of put together a history, but you're not entirely sure if that's accurate, but it's kind of wild.
I don't know. Okay. We have the Bible today. Yes.
Yeah.
We have the Holy Bible. Yes. We have how many versions? How many translations? How many interpretations of like this one?
I think
one text. Right. Okay. And we have how many just Abrahamic religions? More than one, buddy. So and then how many different? How many different spinoffs do we have from that? Like, okay. And it's the same thing with Ohm. I mean, Ohm's stuff would evolve and change and contradict itself constantly. And sometimes some Ohms, even the internal and some of their external propaganda releases, would literally just be the result of Asahara and his inner circle sitting around doing little idea fantasy ping-pongs back and forth. And then someone would just write that down. And they would pretend that it was like a study sesh. It may be maybe a prophecy flash. And they would just print that. That would be like a book. And then how many ways do you... Okay, there are still people who fight over like the best ways to interpret it in its native language, like over in Japan. How many different ways do you think we could just translate the text as is into English over here?
I mean, that's kind of interesting. Like the idea of a translation of like translation, the translator also being the interpreter in the sense of they're not doing a straight mechanical interpretation. They're kind of putting their own like twist or interpretation either accidentally or yeah.
Oh no, you have to, like you have to approach translating Japanese into English that way. If you just do a one-to-one like straight mechanical translation, you're gonna have a bad time and you're not gonna translate it properly. You're not going to convey what it's actually trying to say. But what I'm saying is like, yeah, no, there are some things about QAnon like we're never gonna know. And even a project as ambitious as a Q Origins project, which Q Origins project is amazing. Thank God it's happening. Thank God they're doing it. Somebody fund them. I don't know. But like, you were right. Like, there are still some things like we're never going to know for sure. But I think that's okay. Because like, that's just kind of how it happens.
That kind of fascinates me because it almost seems like some folks have suggested that like, you know, in order to destroy the power of Q, we need to kind of, you know, find out who started Q, dox them, and kind of point out that the king has no clothes, so to speak, or the grifter, it was just a grift or whatever. But it almost seems like that's impossible now. Like maybe that would have been possible in 2017, 2018, but now sitting in 2022, that's just not possible. I mean, is it important to kind of to look at that origin and then say, you know, this isn't some high and mighty idea, rather it was just started by a grifter or started by a yoga instructor? Is there value in sort of, you know, getting to the source and then kind of pointing out that it's not as genuine as you think it is to a believer.
I mean, it's not going to just like change their mind, but I still think it's important to know if it's possible. If it's possible to like really find out and, you know, like definitive, documented, like just irrefutable proof, right? Yeah, if that was possible, that'd be great. And I think it would be really helpful in some ways, but it was never going to like just stop QAnon. Like even back in 2017, 2018, by the time you had people shutting down Hoover Dam to demand their D-class, like doxing Q wasn't going to be enough. Like by then people were already like seeing Qs, like letter Qs being written in the sky and like chemtrails and crying tears of joy. Like, but then like, no. Saying QAnon is a guy named Steve who lives in like Wisconsin in his mom's basement. Like that's not gonna snap him out of it.
So something when I was listening to your other appearances on other podcasts that I had never realized was that Ohm had actually run people for parliament for the, I think the Japanese diet. Please correct me if I'm wrong. And I had to kind of rewind it and listen to it a couple times because I just couldn't believe my what I was hearing, because I was just like, oh, Japan has their own Marjorie Taylor Greene. Oh, that's kind of cool. Universal human experience. But I don't know why I'm laughing, but the podcast kind of quickly moved from that. But if you could you dig into like when Ohm ran for political office, like what was it like, what, like as a cult, what does that political platform look like? What is it just, let me just, yeah. What is that? What were they running on? Basically?
They were running on Shoko. Asahara Shoko, Asahara Shoko. He's our Shoko. He's the world Shoko. We're gonna give some money to schools or some shit, but most importantly, he's our Shoko. Have a balloon with Shoko's face on it. Shoko. Here's a song called Ganesha Gymnastics. We're gonna wear Ganesha mascot outfits. Have we mentioned that Shoko Asahara is also Ganesha? Anyway, vote Shoko and these other dudes, but mostly just Shoko. That was their main platform. And they had their own political party called Shinrito, which is the truth party. So instead of like the Liberal Democratic Party or, you know, the Kometo, which is like some LDP dudes and Sakagakai, they just went and did their own thing. They pulled a happiness realization party before happiness realization party, and they had the Shinrito. And they ran 21-22, including Asahara, for lower house seats in the general elections 1990. So that was great watching the QAnon people start running for local elections in Congress. And I was just like screaming to everyone. And every time the number would go up and one of the DC people or the Q watchers would update their tally. Okay, well now we're up to, I'm like, we're gonna get to Ohm numbers. And they're like, they'll never win. I'm like, Ohm didn't win, but this is, they might. And then they did. So I got to watch that train wreck. And everyone, and I'm like, I'm the Ohm girl. This is literally my job to point out the similarity and make you care about it for more than 4 minutes, because if they succeed where Ohm failed, things are not going to get better anytime soon.
So, yeah, I mean, that's where I feel like the comparison kind of fades away.
No. So had people out in Shoko Asahara paper mache masks and bright yellow Ganesha outfits and the balloons and the, you know, the Asahara song that like it was everywhere and people were just making fun of them because it was goofy. Like no one's gonna like, no, this goofy asshole's out here saying he's God and like Shiva and all this shit, like no one's gonna vote for these people. They're creepy and they smell weird. So he became a meme. All of the school kids, it was funny, like if the NHK or someone came up and they were like, who would you vote for, it would be hilarious if you were a little kid to say Asahara Shoko, And then everyone, like the little kids at school, like they had their little recorders and they would do, 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 do. They would teach themselves the campaign song, the Shoko March. Okay, so like the own people running for the became a meme, and then they lost. And so Wasuharu literally said in response, "We were screwed over by the Freemasons," and by the Freemasons, he meant the shadow cabal of Jewish people, because they were all violent anti-Semites. And he said, because of this, the only path forward is the path of Najrayana. We got to do with terror, because this is war now. We actually won, but they stole it from us. They stole the election from us and laughed at us. And now, the only response.
Oh, this has like stop the steal energy. Okay, I see what you mean. Okay.
So once again, the QAnon people, like Green or Boebert, like those people, yeah, they got a couple in. And what's happening on a local level with, like, you know, school boards and shit, that's popping off. And yeah, the direct comparisons might end. But if you look at the narrative, Ohm's defeat, actual defeat, helped spur them. And man, boy, did they... It was not. That's when they really started ratcheting up, like the preaching the protocols of Zion as like group doctrine, and everything was a Freemason plot. And the paranoia just got really bad. Asahara's psychological state was never that good. It wasn't great to begin with. Like his mind was, he wasn't like exactly healthy, you know. But boy, things got a lot worse after that.
Oh man, I mean, it's just like I feel like QAnon represents almost the worst of both worlds. Like, not only is kind of the, you know, the path to political success is being created. So like getting up and over, you can be a Q person, you can engage in conspiracy theories, and you can be just as successful as Boebert, Green, and maybe even Gosar. But at the same time, there's like this like narrative of we lost, stop the steal. Now it's the time for violence. So we're kind of getting almost, it almost sounds like we're getting the worst of both worlds. So can you tell us, did Ohm ever end? Like, what is the end or the end of that story? If there's even an ending? No.
No. Okay. So the subway attack happens, right? So that was March 20th, 1995. Now, Ohm was responsible for another sarin attack in 1994, the Matsumoto sarin attack. At New Year's Day, 1995, the papers ran a story saying that they had found a certain chemical residue in the soil right outside of Ohm's massive compound at the foot of Mount Fuji, right? And so, like, basically, it had leaked that, like, whatever these big buildings were, we can't say for sure that they were making the sarin, but we can say for sure that there's no way that this particular chemical residue would be in the soil unless somebody nearby had been making sarin. And it was like game over, right? So the attack on the subways was partially just like a response to that. And there's also, like, depending on whose trial testimony you're listening to, there was intel going around, like somebody had let it leak to Ohm and to Asahara that they were about to get mass raided. So they went and did the dumbest thing possible, and they cherry picked some shit out of protocols, and they struck the heart of the government that they believed to be, you know, falsely occupied by some Zionist machine. Tell me if you've heard that one before. They went and they did that, and then the mass raids actually fucking happened. Every facility got rolled up. They sent out, like, Japanese SWAT. The National Police Agency, like, sent pretty much everyone out. Just simultaneous, just massive raids, right? They pushed as many, even just regular members through the systems, through local police departments as they could. And membership plummeted. I was like, they were at, like, what? I was like 11,000 total in Japan, but there was only like, I think, 1,100 Shukeisha. But anyway, the membership obviously like went down because Ohm did terrorisms. So we couldn't be involved in that shit anymore. Okay, but like since then, membership has gone up, and I think like the totals right now are like 1650. They usually stay steady, like membership numbers, like modern now, like it's about 1650 between all three branches or whatever you want to call them. But like it never ended because you can go and you can watch Tatsuya Mori's documentaries, ANA2, which came out in like 1997, 1999, respectively. And they give you a bit of a behind the scenes look of what was going on after those mass raids during those trials. OM was still operating. And then there was like a year or so when they said that they weren't. And then Joyu Fumihiro got let out of jail. And then they rebranded to Olive, like Shoko Asahara told Joyu to. So they did that. But Olive has been around ever since. And tell me if you've heard this before, they've primarily been active online these past 20 years or so. Because they can't really just go out and say, hey, would you like to join OM? Like, that's not gonna fly in Japan. But if you go online and you just pretend to be like a yoga club or a book club that likes weird new age shit, or an astrology club, or someone who's into like prophecies and weird conspiracy theories or whatever, and like you start your own little group there and you start getting and funneling people in. And have like one-on-one conversations with them to where you can condition them to be more receptive to the doctrine that you're actually trying to lay down. Once you get them like really primed and get their minds all open and squishy, you can then tell them that you are actually OM and everything was a conspiracy. And that's how OM is still around. They wouldn't be able to do that without the internet.
It's almost like the being online gives you kind of the ability to be flexible, right? And create layers. Like as you kind of mentioned, what you just said kind of reminds me of Marx's kind of paper on Pastelanon or the yoga 2Q pipeline. I hate characterizing it like that. It makes it sound so awful, but that's kind of crazy. I mean, that's wild that they sort of adapted to the online, and then that adaption, that sort of flexibility was creating these layers of obfuscation until you get to, hey, we're actually a cult and everything's a conspiracy.
These days they use 9/11 conspiracy theories to start priming them. They can get them to go to like an actual yoga class or meetup or whatever. It's usually run out of somebody's apartment, an apartment that they've gotten somebody else to lease just so they can use it as what they might call a classroom. And then they'll go, or they'll rent like, a yoga studio or something and they'll give it like a different name. And then if the student does like well enough and they're receptive enough and they form like, like sort of a personal bond with their trainer or whatever, and they're like, okay, this is a mark, we got one. If they do well enough there, they're told they do well enough and they seem like they're really into it, then they graduate to the different location. And then they're shown like all sorts of conspiracy theory bullshit. And 9/11 conspiracy theories are a big one. Because you have to get them to believe that 9/11 was an inside job and that it was, the Illuminati, the Freemasons, blah, blah, blah. And then once they believe that, they're on the road to believing that the sarin attack was too. And if you get them to believe that the sarin attack was, then you can reveal yourself as OM or Olive or whatever.
Like you're almost like describing a process of radicalization. Like you start off with kind of a person that has, I hate using this characterization, but like a looser understanding of reality or a more mystic understanding. And you kind of just, over time work them into, greater and greater conspiracy theories. Would that be an accurate interpretation or,
Yeah,
maybe. Or
but like,
go ahead.
I don't know. Have you ever been lied to?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the human experience.
Okay. Have you ever known anyone who's ever been in like an abusive relationship?
Unfortunately, I have, yes.
Okay. Well, for some people, it's very easy to pretend to be whatever another person might want you or need you to be. And it's very easy to make them believe things that benefit you personally. For some people, that it's easy to do that with other people. It's very similar principle. Indoctrination, lying, conditioning, undue influence. You can call it all sorts of things. And in different environments, it might work a little differently, but essentially it's kind of, I mean, well, call it what you want.
I mean, so I mean, when we start looking for signs of somebody being put on that track, right, of they're moving towards a direction that is, you know, moving into a high control group or moving into a high control belief. I don't know what the phrase would be, but what do we look for? What do we monitor? Like I almost feel like so much of our resources are put on the end product. Like the person has already become a Nazi. They've already become a QAnon believer. They've already engaged with the material and decided to internalize it. Remember our conversation with Shannon. It was very much about the end product. Or we didn't do a show on this, but like in conversation with my social worker friends, it's just like, it's always, they don't come to the social worker or the therapist in the middle of it, nor does the social worker go and experience the middle of the path. It's always the end. It's always, you know, this person has, you know, gone to jail because they committed a hate crime and now are kind of being assigned a social worker or being assigned, you know, a parole officer or somebody to work with them. But, you know, sorry about that story, going back to my question, but how do we sort of look for and monitor when somebody is in that process and in that pipeline? Is it even worthwhile to do it? And just kind of have to wait for them to do something awful? But, you know, what is the sort of the suggestion or sort of the idea here?
I personally have to believe that prevention and recovery are like two sides of the same coin. It's like in the earlier days of the QAnon stuff, you know, like when I was trying to like raise hell, and then, you know, someone might take me seriously and they'd be like, well, what are we supposed to do? What's your plan? And I'm like, we could look at the Japanese response to the Ohm affair. We could try that. As you had people who were like raising the alarms and you had these family members who were trying to get their loved ones out of Ohm. You had all of these journalists and all of these columnists really working together. And yeah, that even included like law enforcement and stuff. Working together to try to stop it from getting as bad as it did. And then after it did get as bad as it did, they all came together again and they just joined up their little organizations. And then a new one was founded on top of that. It was like the Japan Society for Cult Prevention and Recovery. And the cult prevention part and the cult recovery part are treated like they're equally as important. Because the whole point is to make sure that something like the Ohm affair that never happened again. So you had the JSCPR, but then you also had the Ohm Shinrikyo Family Association, which had been around since I think the late 80s, where the whole entire point was to give the families a place, like an actual professional support group, a secure one that had been vetted, where like they could talk about their feelings like losing their children or their moms or their dads or whatever to this type of organization. And then you also had something called the Canary Association, the Canaries. And the Canaries, those were for former believers, where they had a safe place to talk about things that only they would understand. And they were given like, you know, actual like resources who helped them recover and helped them adjust. But then another part of the JSCPR's entire thing is that they have like these education initiatives. And they'll put out pamphlets and they'll go to universities and they'll just distribute literature and make sure that there are pamphlets around town that says, here's what to look for. If a group is acting like this, if a group is getting your friend to act like this, like this might be a bad group. And here are maybe some steps you can try to take to help it from like prevent it from getting worse and cut it off. But like we don't do that here. It's still so hard to just get people to take things like cults and manipulation tactics and things like that seriously. and you have to give yourself away to melodramatics and histrionics just to get the attention of people who should already know these things and should already be helping fucking get that literature and those educational shorts made and distributed to like a wider audience. I don't know.
So could you kind of elaborate on what was considered? So you kind of showed us what prevention looks like, you know, be aware, be, you know, be cognizant of these signs. But kind of the two questions I have is, what does recovery look like? And what was the government's role in it? Was this all done through kind of the private sector and through sort of society? Or did the Japanese government kind of have this strong role involvement?
The Japanese government debated over whether or not to apply old laws that could technically outlaw Om Shinrikyo, period. And then they decided not to. And I'm trying to think. And then like part of the anti-Om laws was to put together a fund for the survivors of the sarin attacks and, you know, victims of Om's violence. I guess it's like the government's response to 9/11 in a way. You know, like they put some money up and then it wasn't enough, and then it started to just dwindle, but like, oh well, good luck. That was forever ago. Sorry about it. No, the things like the JSCPR and the Canaries and the Families Fund and even the Victims Fund are the Families Association and even the Victims Association now, they're mostly private sector. There's coordination with like local, I guess you could say, governments, like in like wards and stuff, like the police there, but
I mean, what, like, I kind of struggle to understand why in 2022 it's so hard for folks to kind of do this, like to organize this on their own. Like, I know there's the subreddit where people can kind of talk about having family members join Q and sort of the damage that's been done. But like, I really kind of struggle to understand why in America, why we can't kind of do this, or why it's been such an uphill battle for, you know, such an uphill battle. Like I because like the expertise is there. Like you have people like Steve Hansen, and you have a lot of, at least in Colorado, you have a lot of practices kind of devoted to focusing on people who have joined cults. Like you have, I think one practice I looked at in doing the research for the show was a mix of MDs and social workers, so MDs and LCSWs.
Gotta take back your life recovery.
I don't know if they're based in Colorado, but it was just like just looking at different practices here in Denver. But I mean, what in your view, like why is it such an uphill battle? Like I don't quite understand. Maybe I'm like just naive and still an amateur, but I just don't understand.
It's something I don't understand either. Maybe that's also because I'm an amateur and I'm not like a smooth talker. So I can't get you a government grant. Sorry. So I'm pretty worthless when it comes to the fight that apparently, like, the only fight that matters, which is fun. No, it is an uphill battle. You've got the expertise there. I mean, there used to be an inpatient. I think there still is at least one dedicated inpatient. I think it's Wellspring. If it's still to recover from cultic spiritual abuse. And then, you know, we have, you know, little things like what you're talking about. And then we have something great with Take Back Your Life that's just getting up and going. So if anybody wants to go check that out, maybe donate to it. That'd be pretty cool. But no, like for a while there, if you remember, and especially like once Trump took office and then Charlottesville, you know, a Unite the Right rally happened and stuff. CVE and exit programs were like the Wild West. It was like a gold rush, you know? Everybody wanted a cure for hate. Everybody wanted an easy answer to, you know, get their precious baby boys off of 4chan or whatever, which opened up the field to a lot of stuff. I'm not really qualified to talk about that. When I say the field, I don't feel like I'm really part of the gang, because I only spent, some people spend their entire lives getting a fancy piece of paper so that they can go and get paid a bunch of money to rewrite the same article about Adam Waffen that came out like 2 years ago. I just spent like 3 years making a total jackass out of myself to like try to get people to stop making Jonestown jokes long enough to start really talking about what we can do to help get Pep and Grandma away from QAnon before something really bad happens. And then something really bad happened, and then something really, really bad happened, and now everyone's, it's like the Wild West again.
I also think like some of it is like, so I was having like a discussion with my therapist friend, and we got on this topic. I told her that I was talking to Sarah Hightower. We're going to discuss like a lot of like the idea of like, you know, pulling people out of movements and whatnot, or not pulling, but getting them out of cults and stuff like that. And we happened upon the topic of COVID, right? It's 2022, it's COVID times. And she mentioned something that was kind of blew my mind. And it just kind of has stuck with me, that she was talking about a certain patient that, you know, is upper middle class, has money, educated. But the patient kind of admitted that they were taking ivermectin instead of getting vaccinated. And then not the pill ivermectin, right? Not the human pharmaceutical, but derisively the horse paste, which kind of blew my mind. Like, I know that like anybody can join a cult. It's just a matter of belief, but it just, to have it like throw, like put into my face, like here's somebody who's successful. They're going to this upper middle class, you know, therapist, you know, in a fancy building in Denver. And they're giving into this conspiracy theory of, if I eat enough horse paste, then I won't get the Rona. But I mean, like, sorry, I don't mean to trivialize, but it's just like,
no.
Like, it just seems like just getting somebody, challenging their beliefs, and then getting them to, you know, say, admitting that they're wrong, or acting like kind of either a vocal admission of being wrong or a quiet admission is very challenging. And it kind of crosses the bounds of, I guess it's a belief, so it wouldn't necessarily be tied to finances or professional success or whatever.
Have you ever heard of Minecraft? It's
yes,
a little game. It's I don't know. It's a little indie. I don't know if you've ever
heard of it. It's just a small indie Minecraft game.
Yeah, I
think I've heard of it.
I think, it comes pre-installed with like Solitaire. So there was the creator of Minecraft. He goes by Notch. There was this brief little period there when he was flirting with QAnon stuff, because he was already. For listeners who might not know, the creator of the enormously popular video game Minecraft, Notch, he got bought out, I think, by Microsoft, and he no longer gets credited for like his own creation, because that dude got really gross and really racist pretty quick, and he doubled and tripled down on it. So like he's worth like billions of dollars, but he's like the loneliest dude in the world, and he's just off doing his own thing. So, like, that dude was flirting with QAnon, and the QAnon people were trying really hard to get Notch as, like, an advertising tower. And I jumped in, and I started, like, I was almost there. I almost got through to, like, rich Fedora Minecraft man. And then, like, the dudes I was working with at the time, they were kind of like trolls, and they wouldn't, like, shut up long enough to, like, maybe just let me be on the same autistic wavelength as the Minecraft man. But man, I was so close. He was so close to admitting he might be wrong about that. And that was like, oh, it's hard, but you can do it. Maybe if you can get on the same wavelength, talk to them in their language. No guarantees.
You know, that's kind of to build on that. Like, that's what I find is so challenging, is like sitting there, like explaining to people that anyone can join a cult. Anyone can have extremist beliefs. Like, it's kind of free of finances and professional success and academic success. Like, it's almost become a fucking trope in my life, where somebody will inevitably at a social event inevitably mention that I have a podcast, and then we start talking about the content of the podcast, and they're like, and then it'll just become something like, oh, I will never join a cult. I'll never join a terrorist group. And then I just sit there and I'm like, you know, Bin Laden was a billionaire. You know, like all the members of Al-Qaeda were engineers, like as smart people, or you switch footing to the white supremacist tradition. And it's like, oh, Wesley Swift was an accomplished preacher, or J.B. Stoner was an attorney, or Richard Spencer is a doctorate from Duke or whatever the fuck. But I just find like there's so many communications challenges as like researchers or people who are kind of adjacent to it. It just makes me want to just, you know, throw, like, just hide under my desk and cry for a while.
When, like, one of the people who's been, like, the most successful with, like, you know, messaging, like, getting the right sort of messaging out there and reaching a broad enough audience to, like, make them otherwise, like, you know, the Steakums guy, Nathan. Like, Nathan tweeted the frozen meat empathy screed from the Steakums brand account and made more people like see their influenced pep cups as human again overnight. He reached more people overnight with viral fucking Mr. Rogers Steakums time than I think most of us had in like the months or maybe years prior. Isn't it fucked up? Isn't it? Okay, and then like I'm out here like, look, I can get you in touch with, I can get you hooked up with the people fighting cults in Japan, the people who fought former OM members, sarin attack survivors, like the people who founded the JSCPR and people on board that like the board of directors and stuff. I can help refer you to these people. Okay, I've met some of them in person. Like it's, I can help you. Like crickets. And then someone just has to come along and say, I have an Emmy. It was Russia. It was a PSYOP. It was Russia. If you disagree, you're part of the PSYOP. Give me $25,000 because I'm starting a recovery organization to save our parents, to save your pep peps. And I'm like, uh-huh. And that got more heat. Like an actual liar. Actual grifter who did not know the first actual thing about QAnon. And that grifter was able to get more heat and get more people to buy into their narrative and their mythos and their weird fucked up hero's journey. Like,
I mean, you touch on something that's kind of interesting, like as researchers, like the constant researchers and sort of people in the field, like this constant struggle to not only communicate, you know, what we're engaged on, but also getting through the grift wall or the fucking, like the grifters, like it's just, I mean, that's, it's just the most frustrating thing. Like I just like talking to normies and it's like, to your point, it's just like, they're more influenced by Steakums and the Blue Anon adjacent weird grifters.
Yeah. But like the Steakums, Nathan was doing it right. Like, yeah, it's sad that it had to be like this, the absurdity or the novelty of something like that coming from like a Steakums account, like, but like Nathan did it right and I mean, like he's really cool and good. It's just like it is a bit disheartening that it, you know, it had to be like just because of the novelty of it coming from a checkmark Twitter brand account for a frozen meat product.
I mean, but
like he actually did good.
Oh, I mean, why is that though? Like I just, like that, I think that's one of the struggles that I really have a hard time like understanding or explaining to myself, like why normies can't conceive of that they could be a victim of high influence, of undue influence, or there's like, it almost seems like a lot of people, it's either a lack of empathy or a sort of internal denial. Like, I don't want to empathize with QAnon people because they believe in a dumb thing, or it's like a denial of, you know, if, you know, it's expressed in very various ways, but the most common one seems to be, I couldn't believe this, right? I can't believe something as ridiculous as Q.
Yeah.
And then kind of, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, it's also hard for a lot of people to have empathy, I guess, because like QAnon stuff, like, it is gross. It is, I don't know, it's not just something a little quirky. Like, it is hardcore anti-Semitism and, like, the hatred. Like, I talked about it tickling the parts of your brain that trigger your existential fight or flight, and tickles the part of your brain that releases, you know, the hate chemicals and stuff. But it's, it, I mean, no one needs me to say that it's racist and gross and violent, but yeah, that also makes it harder for, like, normies who, you know, have enough sense to know that, like, okay, no, that's bad. That's bad, man. It becomes harder for them to empathize. And you also don't want to press the undue influence thing or the manipulation thing too hard, because you don't want to just give people free passes. You know?
Oh.
They do. Yeah, all right. You fell down a rabbit hole, and you did genuinely believe all of these things, and you didn't, you know, either you didn't listen when people tried to say that it's just bacon wrapped protocols for Facebook boomers, and then you did end up believing that the Jews control the world and the banks, and that white genocide is real, and that the vaccine is up, and blah 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 blah. But, like, you still did believe and perpetuate those things. So if you just roll up after and say it wasn't poor little baby's fault, they were brainwashed, people are not going to be on board with that. And, like, you can't expect people to be on board with that, because that taking it too far in that direction is not cool. Like, that's bullshit.
That's kind of interesting, the need for accountability for somebody's beliefs, but at the same time, striking a middle ground between, you know, holding somebody accountable and then not holding them accountable. Like, you know, oh, you did join this group, but at the same time, not being forgiving. Like, can we explore that a bit? Like, how do we hold somebody accountable for their belief in Q without alienating them?
I mean, you can look at what different sorts of groups have done in the recovery effort. You have, look at what, like, Life After Hate, You Hope Not Hate, Exit USA, Exit UK, Exit Australia, New Zealand. It'll look at those exit groups. And it is, like, you know, you do successfully, like, get someone out. That's just, like, not the end of it. Like, usually, and the good ones won't do it in front of the cameras, but usually the process will begin with, you know, taking them maybe into places and communities that you've prearranged, and it's cool for you to take them there. Like, they're expecting you. And then, like, you take them and you help reacclimate them. And it's like, here's how we can begin to repair some of the damages that you caused by actively perpetuating, like, this violent racist bullshit. You know, I've known quite a few former members of cults and hate groups or whatever, right? Of arranging a visit to, like, a synagogue or a talk with a rabbi, or, you know, a brunch with the girls, things like that. Like, there has to be, I guess you could say, like, if you're calling for some sort of accountability, you're not telling this person to go, like, you know, give, like, just, like, lash themselves in public. But, like, there is a process. Like, you had Shannon on. This is literally what Shannon does. But accountability kind of starts at home.
I keep thinking, like, in my head, I can't help but go back to the very online nature of Q, and God, it just the amount of work ahead of a lot of people is just immense. I think about it, like, in terms of my job and how kind of like an adversarial kind of thinking. And I think, like, oh my gosh, Q is able to spread itself online and it can just literally get hundreds of thousands of millions of people. And then I listen to you, I listen to Shannon, I listen to my social worker friends and my psychiatrist friends. And it's just like it takes months or years just to bring one person out or bring two people out. And it's just the scale of the problem is just, it's literally giving me an anxiety attack, unfortunately. It's just like, how do you, as somebody, you know, how do you kind of conceptualize that problem of scale? Is it just like you just kind of have to shrug your shoulders and whoever you can bring out, you can bring out? Or, you know, how do you understand that problem?
I used to just jump in. I would jump in like, you show me a pit, show me a bad scene, I will be reckless and very stupid and over emotional and self-destructive, and I'll jump in and see what I can do, because I don't see anyone else in here and we're supposed to meet them where we're at, I've been told. So let's do this. That also is that's not gonna work. Even if you're trained, you might know how to navigate it better and you might know to avoid it in the first place, but you're right, it's, I don't even know where to start, man. But it's also not like my job to know where to start, because there are people who go to school for a very long time just to get fancy pieces of paper to rewrite things that have already been written. But there are also a lot of people who go to school for a very long time to, like, you know, jump out in front and be at the forefront of getting shit done. So, unfortunately, I know a lot of people who are actually jumping out at the forefront and actually working to try to make things better and get shit done. And I didn't feel as hopeful. The bit of hope I have today, I didn't have like 2 or 3 years ago. I don't have to solve the world's problems today. So that, like, we actually got good people on it. I feel really good about that.
That's good. I mean, having hope is kind of, I guess the I want to say the first step to kind of, I mean, it's the first step, and like it's having hope. It's like, it's a good thing. Like, I just felt like, I think from 2018, I mean, actually earlier than that, since Charlottesville, kind of my hope has kind of plummeted, because it's just like, you know, it's, you know, I think it was the first time seeing that footage on Vice of people saying Jews will not replace us. And it's like, it just looks like what I imagine a Klan rally would look like, but all their faces are out, which means like you're not wearing a mask. That's like a fuck you, come catch us. Like, it's just, like, they don't care. I think to your point, like, recently I've had a lot more hope. And I think a lot of that has to do with like being in a social worker and a psychiatrist space. And it's like, they're very like aware of like people where like they're aware and they're getting training and getting practice with people who are coming out. Unfortunately, in most cases, it's like people who have violated the law, who have gone to prison, and now are trying to repair their life. But I mean, it's there's hope there, right? It feels like it's on the upswing.
Yeah, it's a QAnon stuff, like, it's an accelerations problem now. I mean, it always was, but man, it's just grown so much. And it was so easy, bad actors to amplify or direct, jump in, further radicalize. And one of the reasons I feel a bit better today than I did a few years ago is because today I know a few more people who also watched some of these accelerationist groups go into various QAnon spaces and start killing them on like Christian identity and saint killing them and stuff. Oh, it's like back in the day I would try talking about it, like, and it was like someone was either like, well, she's being melodramatic or whatever. But then, like, now I know some pros who are like, no, yeah, we watch it. Yeah, that, yeah, they're in there. They admitted to it here. Yeah, we watched it. And I'm like, oh, cool. Well, you're actually really professionals. Get the fuck out in front of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think to your point, like a lot more people are cognizant of extremism. Like, it's like I just take my, like, I don't mean to be like self-centered, but like taking myself as an example and like networking with really good researchers on Twitter. Like, I don't, like, I think like following you on Twitter has been kind of weirdly influential, because it put me on a path of reading Stein, reading Lifton. You basically Lifton-pilled me.
I get that a lot. I don't get paid much, but I get that a lot. I get like all of these like like the people, like when you think about this group or this threat, who are the first few people who come to mind, chances are they've probably said at some point, oh, Hightower taught me about lifting. Hightower made me think about this. Hightower did this. I'm like, oh, I guess I'm like the Steve Parrish of this, but
so
the Courtney Love of this.
So when I wrote a request email to Lifton's people to like bring him on the show, I had to delete, Chelsea made me delete the word Lifton pilled, because apparently sending that to a publisher is not a good look. Be like, I've been Lifton pilled, please come on my podcast. I just hope as a like this 95-year-old guy, he knows like how many young researchers have just been eating up like his work. I just hope like somewhere, wherever he is, he's just like, just giving everybody the thumbs up, like good work guys or something.
Get Lifton on like a Twitch debater show. Getting Lifton on like, oh God, one of those douchebags like Hassan Piker are like, have Lifton debate Destiny. Don't do that. Don't. Send anyone to that guy. He sucks, but it's like, get Lifton on some of these Twitch streams.
Oh my gosh. Oh.
Send to the youth. I'm sure they'd love him. I'm sure they'd like be.
But I mean, like social media, like in some ways, has been like super positive, like learning it's about Christian. Okay. No, I mean, like learning about the Christian identity movement.
That can only be that can only be considered positive in like maybe one way. And for every one of you, there's like a. God knows how many of the others. My heroes keep turning into TERFs. You're talking about like getting like, I hope Lifton knows that all of these young researchers are looking up to him. Lifton on social media. And I'm like, no, if you get Robert J. Lifton on Twitter, he's going to start talking about bathrooms and stuff. It's, I watched it happen to Taro Takimoto, the founder of JSCPR, who survived like a sarin attack, a VX attack, and an anthrax attack, I think, from Ohm. And I'm watching it happen to another cult expert. like let's keep Lifton offline. And we can communicate with him. You can interview him via like carrier pigeon.
So I think we have gone through all the questions I had that I've written down. As you know, per Twitter, the legit question list got deleted, and then Chelsea found out and restored them because the one that I had written,
very kind of,
it was 90% wrestling questions. And why do, like, for instance, like why does 7-Eleven in Japan kick so much ass versus 7-Eleven here in the United States, which is, I don't know if you know this, but I fell into 7-Eleven TikTok, Japanese 7-Eleven TikTok. So it's literally people just going into Japanese 7-Elevens, and I'm very jealous because they could get like rice balls and stuff.
Have you ever heard of a podcast called the Konbini Boys?
No, I haven't.
A Japanese word for the convenience stores and stuff is a konbini. So the Konbini Boys, they're two expats, and they have this really awesome podcast, and it's just about how cool the convenience stores are and what the convenience stores have going on that month.
That's awesome.
No, it's great.
But I'll tell you a little secret. I actually struggled to make onigiri, like the rice balls. Like I have, it's the only thing in my kitchen that gives me like pain. Like I just, for some reason, I can never get it right, and it's just I just make rice, and then I you know, ball it up and then kind of fry it, but put it on the iron skillet, and it just, for some reason, I can never get it correct. It just ends up falling apart, and I just kind of standing over the sink just putting rice in, just eating poorly made.
Buy some azumirin.
What was it?
Azumirin. Get like some sweet rice vinegar. You're gonna need something to help like actually like make the rice kind of like bond and stick together, and you're gonna need some seaweed. You're gonna need some dried seaweed. You'll need like a nori wrapper or something that'll also help hold it together, and it'll need to dry out a bit. But if you're just like making some rice and smushing it together, that's not gonna work. Like you're gonna need like some ajumirin.
Just smushing like ah
yeah like some sweet rice vinegar. It doesn't change the taste too much, but like you'll need something like that. Or you could like use some glutinous rice if you don't have rice. Yeah, get like some I think like some botan. Get some glutinous rice. If you have any mochi, you can put a little bit of mochi into the rice cooker with the regular rice if you don't have glutinous rice, and it'll kind of have the same effect.
So for my second fun question, I have to ask you about wrestling.
Okay.
So first, who's your favorite wrestler? And is it Mick Foley?
Like favorite wrestler from which promotion and which era we were talking about? Because if we're talking about right now, it's MJF.
Oh man, I haven't kept up with it. So like basically my actually watching wrestling peaked during the Attitude Era. And then during COVID, I got back into Jim Cornette's podcast because I just like just working from home. Like I found out, like I just needed something to play in the background. And I started listening to Jim Cornette and then Vice's the Dark Side of the Ring. And I just those two things just got me back into the lore of wrestling. And just like, I don't know what's it about the history of wrestling that just kind of ticks with me. It just works. Like maybe it's like Jim Cornette, the way that he sells and he kind of every like podcast is basically an extended promo. I just got back into the wrestling history, which is kind of refreshing. Yeah. So I would say, go ahead.
I hated wrestling during the Attitude Era because I was like a little girl and I live here in like the middle of nowhere, Arkansas, and I come from like a poor family. So I felt like it was expected of me and everyone else really liked it. But then if you didn't like it, you were probably the type of person who made fun of wrestling fans. And if you were making fun of wrestling fans, then we were all rednecks and inbreds, shoeless, toothless, morons, mouth breathers, all that sort of stuff. And I'm like, that's not me. I hate this. I'm in fifth grade. Screw you. I'm smart. I know what Om Shirikyo is. I watched Neon Genesis Evangelion. I'm smart. I don't like this crap. And
wait. So in fifth grade, you're watching
Neon. That's an exaggeration.
Oh,
it was actually like 6 or 7.
I have an image in my head of you as a precocious sixth grader. Just be like, hey guys, let's get in the robot.
and then later in like high school, my mom remarried an asshole and he sucks, and I my mom remarried like this jerk and he was like sort of a beefhead back then, and he was really into wrestling. And so when it would come on UPN, there was one TV in the house because we were still poor, and he would watch it on that. And I came in one night and I saw like Eddie Guerrero just like screwing around in the ring, and I was like, oh, who's that? And then my stepdad, I don't know, probably said something racist because he sucks. And then I watched an Eddie Guerrero match, and then I was like, I think I understand what this is now, and I hate myself for not watching it sooner because this is awesome. So Eddie Guerrero got me into professional wrestling, and then I understood that it was just like, it's like a soap opera with spandex. It's like anime. It's like live action anime bullshit.
Yeah, like,
and you have like characters and they're hamming it up for the audience. Like it's theater.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the words to describe it, but like when like Mick Foley, some of his peak ECW interviews, promos, and then some of his work in the what was then the WWF. I don't know, it just like touched me in a way that like very few pieces of content or media affect me. I think I put it in a thread on Twitter, the one where it's Cactus Jack's introduction to the WWF. So at that point he had been through WCW and the ECW, and all the fans know who Cactus Jack is. And it's just, everything was so perfect, the way that the Dude Love introduced everybody. And then Triple H is like selling like, Cactus Jack, big threat. But I just there's something about like the interviews and sort of his style. I mean, I've heard he's like a completely like nice guy. He's like fame has never gotten to his head or anything.
I know a couple of people who have worked with Mick Foley.
Yeah. So I think we're near the time. We've answered all the questions. Talked about wrestling, talked about rice balls. So usually when we end the show, we kind of open it up for the guests. So leave us with something to think about, something to chew on, something that will kind of leave us as the audience and the interviewer is something to think about, something to say, like, wow, that's something that I really kind of want to think about and grow upon.
Man, don't put me on the spot like this. You know what every single member of Omshin Rikyo had in common?
No, what did they have in common?
They wanted to save the world. They loved the world. Originally. Nobody joined Omshin Rikyo because they thought they were going to end up, you know, taking the diamond vehicle to Saren Town. It was that love and just that open-mindedness. And I guess what some people might cynically say is, I don't know, naivety or mushy-mindedness or a certain type of mindset or whatever. Like, I prefer to think of it as sort of purity. But that sort of purity can easily be exploited. Every single member of Omshin Rikyo, like, they walked into that wanting to be good. People don't really think about, and I get it, because, like, it's in the past, and you move on or whatever, and it was never important over here, but, like, if you're thinking about how people end up in groups like QAnon, or ISIS, or fucking Adam Waffen, or, like, O9A, you think about how people ended up in Om. And if you can understand some of that sort of thinking without having like an opinion on it one way or the other, but just simply sort of understand it, maybe someone smarter than me could do something with that. I don't know. But I think there are still gaps in like academia and whatnot that I would like to help people fill and, you know, get this stuff to people who are smarter than me and people who, like, you know, didn't come back when they heard these people were going to be executed to try to make people care, like people who, like, actually chose this and chose to devote their life to this and stayed in school for a billion years and got that nice piece of paper or stayed writing articles about it and, you know, got those accolades. Like, that's what I wanted to do when I first started. Like 3 years ago, if you told me I was going to be like talking to you on a show for the audience that you have, I would have been like, no, I'd like to find a way to make it about Om again, but I can't do it on my own. So I hope I made myself sound sufficiently crazy. Thanks for having me on, Scott.
That was Sarah Hightower. And thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show, Sarah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. This is awkward.